Hello and welcome to Hunan Quest, I mean Saga Quest, episode 374. I'm your host, Mike Epps, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
Vengeful Seven, David McBurney, Family Master.
Nice. And I get to talk about a review game I've been hinting at for the past 2 weeks.
And also accidentally put on.
Yes. Well, that was during Sunday Night Shenanigans. And I don't think anyone was actually even watching us. So it worked out.
Yeah, so no one thought. No one has to know.
But yeah, I've been playing the hell out of it. And considering I had trouble ever getting into the original, I jumped at the chance to review this. Had second thoughts. And then re-jumped at the chance to review this, and I'm glad I did, because it's really fucking good. I guess I should just jump right into some of this, if that's okay. Or should we talk about something else
first?
Should we do news first? Okay. This is a full-on remake of Romantic Saga 2, originally released for the Super Famicom. Did not come out in the U.S. officially until... I don't know when those versions even came
2016,
out.
2016,
2017. Yeah. I don't think they updated those a lot, so... I mean, unless you were...
They were updated to some extent, like they had some additional content and such, but for the most part, they were relatively loyal to the originals.
Yeah. Which means, yeah, they're very, that and three, they're very good and interesting games, but they can be a lot, especially if you don't have the time to try and figure out some of their intricacies, because they don't exactly spell it out for you. And I feel like this remake does a really amazing job of sanding off the rough edges of not just the original, but kind of a lot of things that people don't get about Saga games. Well, not...
It's a very...
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a very good, like, first Saga game to help you understand how they're supposed to work.
Yeah. And although it helps you understand how they work, what it doesn't do is hold your hand completely through the experience. And
doesn't sand off the... It doesn't make them play less... It doesn't make it play more conventionally.
Right. If you go into this and... say whatever, and try to just brute force your way in combat, you will fail in spectacular fashion.
Right.
And I'm playing this on normal. Like, the battles do not fuck around at all. And you need to get into battle to level up the classes, which persist through the generations, which I'll talk about in a second. But, I mean, any battle is a chance to lose some life points on a character and potentially lose them completely for that generation, and it's not good. So, yeah, the game does a lot of things to ease your way into this experience. And it's a lot, so I think it's good. It's good for to ease your way into it. Like, it starts off with you're a named emperor with a father, and it kind of goes through a storyline of how this father learns to pass down power through the generations, which is essentially setting up the whole conceit where you'll be able to essentially become a new emperor as the game progresses over and over again. I think from what I read and the info they gave me, it can be an infinite number, I guess, to some extent.
Mm.
And I mean, it's, so the way it progresses is, you know, you'll complete some quests and it'll force you to pick a new emperor and kind of advance the generation. If you wipe, it will force you to the next generation, although this isn't like some roguelikes where it, you know, it auto saves and it, there's kind of no way to reload a save. You can go and reload a save. I wish there was a way to kind of do it from right after you die. There isn't. You'd have to like exit to the game or just continue on and get to the point where you can access the menu again to reload a save. That's one minor complaint, but
relatively in edge case.
Yeah. The whole concept of the game is there were 7 legendary heroes who saved the world, and they're rumored to come back someday to save the world, and they do come back, and they do the exact opposite of that, and
big old assholes.
Yes, are big old giant assholes. You can find some cutscenes as you progress in the game that kind of show what exactly was going on with them, although they're hidden and not necessarily given to you in a chronological order. But I kind of like it that way, that it's a mystery that you have to try and solve.
That's a very Saga way to move the story along.
I think it works better by the game not just spelling it out for you, by it being this great mystery as you go along. Because when you fight these people, they are fucking assholes. And they will curse your name and say when they come back, they're going to fuck your shit. Like, these are not people that you go and beat and they're like, oh, I don't know where I went wrong or something. No, they're fucking evil. So I won't spoil anything about what exactly went on with them because I haven't even seen it all yet. But it is certainly interesting.
Nothing good.
No. Early on in the game, it kind of gives you, there's a kind of a linear path you have to go through to kind of unlock more areas for you to explore. But once you kind of get past that, man, does the game open up. And although it paints a bunch of quest spots on the map, like, hey, here's where some of these heroes are. It don't tell you how to get there at all. You kind of have to figure that out by yourself. You go do some quests, and it will unlock new areas, and you can kind of progress further along the map. And I just found the ninja class, I think. Sweet. Okay, hold on. What was I saying? So yeah, you kind of have to find your way through quests, and it unlocks more of the map, and eventually you'll start to find the 7 heroes. One I found accidentally, which was kind of fucking awesome. I told you about this. I'm not going to say where it was, but I was in a dungeon completing what I thought was just like some innocuous quest, getting to the end, thinking, okay, I'm just going to fight some random boss, and it's just like, no, this is one of the 7 heroes. This is a huge boss battle, a huge epic boss battle, and they are tough, cool, awesome boss battles. Good. Yeah. And most bosses in this game, not just the 7 heroes, will have different tricks and things they can do. Like I fought a giant termite queen who will summon more termites as you fight and will eat them to regain health, based on how much life those termites had left, which it makes it a complicated fight and a battle of attrition. So this game is really, really, really good. If it wasn't a remake, I would say it could be an RPG of the Year contender, but I think that's probably going to be Metaphor. But we'll see. Yeah.
For me, it'll still be FF7 Rebirth.
That's true. But yeah, there's a ton in this game, and it really does feel like if you were a fan of kind of these weird open Super Nintendo RPGs, it's that in
Back,
3D
baby.
with lots of monster, not monster, lots of modern niceties and updates. That again, like I said, they make it easier. Reminds me of some things I said about Emerald Beyond. Like the game does a very good job of just pointing you forward, so you're always making progress. It's like kind of holding your hand, but not really. Just getting rid of the time in games where you just wander around being like, well, where am I going? Do I have to go around, go to every town and like talk to every NPC? Some of the things you'd see in older games and probably even some newer games, especially some indie games. Just like, here's a spot on the map. There's things to do here. Try and find your way there. Like just pointing you in the right direction, but this game is not going to just drag you along the right way. You can wander around, find side quests, find new classes to unlock, find materials to blacksmith new weapons, find all the hidden Mr. S's that are, so I think there's like 50 or so hidden throughout the game. And those give you special bonuses. This is a huge, huge game, which again, coming as a remake of a Super Nintendo game, seems very impressive to me. I really can't say enough nice things about what they've done here. Like this is seriously, shockingly impressive.
Huzzah!
And
From the
it is so nice to see like a saga game feel like it has an actual budget. Like I love Emerald Beyond. That game,
it was made on the cheap.
yes, that game is very clearly made on the cheap, and was probably made on less, even less than we probably think. So I mean, good on them for doing the most they could with the little resources, but if this is an example of what a modern saga game could look like with an actual budget, if this does any kind of well sales-wise, then man, this series can go some places, and that makes me very, very excited.
Made from the developers of your friends and mine, the developers of the Trials of Mana remake, and it
Yes.
looks like it.
No, it definitely does. Like some of the character designs even look like they were almost pulled directly from that, but not in a bad way, in a good way.
Yeah.
If you like saga games, play this as soon as you possibly can. If you've ever been interested in saga games but always scared that they're too obtuse, play this game. If you like JRPGs of any kind, play this fucking game right now. Do it.
If you've ever wondered about Saga at all, like this is one to jump in on simply because
Seriously.
like it's got some of the least punishing mechanics. Like if you don't understand the mechanics, this one will help you understand how they work, and it also just is structured in such a way as if you don't get it, it's fine. It's fine. It expects you to, you will wipe sometimes. That's
Yep.
fine. That's built into the loop.
And if you do play it, I recommend probably not doing what I did. Try as many classes as you can, especially for your Emperor.
Yeah, your emperor is built around like just retaining benefits from every class that your other emperors have been. So your emperor just gets stronger the more kinds of classes you've been.
And another nice thing, I don't know if this was in the original. So if you use another class and it masters a skill, like say, I don't know, some really cool spear skill, like the Glimmer, a really cool spear skill, and you master that, you can then add that skill to other characters that also use spears. So like you don't have to, any cool ability you can get, you can spread it around to other characters. You don't have to keep trying to like get them to learn them. And another nice,
yeah, you just need to get one person to know something, and then you can get it to other people.
Yeah, and another nice thing here with that whole system is if when you're in a battle, you'll see some skills with like a little light bulb icon next to them, which means if you use them, there's a higher chance that you're going to glimmer a new skill. And I've tested out a lot, and it happens pretty frequently. It's not like, not necessarily like the first time you use it, but you keep doing it, and they will definitely glimmer a skill. And there's definitely,
yeah, you're not going to be wasting your time if you're trying to, and you know, just making the glimmering system a little less opaque will probably be enough for most people, I think.
Yeah.
Because, like, the, you know, people who played these games start to, even if they aren't aware of how the system works, start to realize, like, oh, you're more likely to glimmer things against harder enemies. Like, glimmering is something that does happen, that just sort of happens as long as you're, you know, using a variety of abilities and, like, you know, as long as you keep using a set of weapons and skills or whatever, you're going to glimmer stuff fairly, you know, often enough. But, you know, it definitely turns off a lot of people not having any idea how that system works.
Yeah.
So, just that little bit of extra guidance for how it works should probably be enough for a lot of people.
And so another nice thing they added here is every monster has weaknesses, and as soon as you find them, they're kind of recorded, and you will always see them when you're fighting that monster. But hitting weaknesses has a huge benefit, even if you're not necessarily doing max damage, is that you're building up like a meter towards the hell is the actual name of the combination skills or something like that. Essentially, at first just two, and then eventually you get the ability to, after you've used them a few times in a single battle, you can combine with multiple characters. Essentially, your characters will use multiple skills at once, but with vastly increased damage. And given how hard things hit in battle, having that in your back pocket to help end battles quicker, so you know, you reduce the risk of losing some LP on your characters, is huge. And it definitely adds a lot of strategy to the battle system, so that's another nice addition in a game already full of many of them. I mean, I can just talk about so many things in this game. Like, the art design is wonderful. Like, all the monsters look cool. All the character classes have cool, distinct looks. It's what else can I talk about in this game? The remastered soundtrack is amazing.
But you also have the option for the original, if that's your preference.
Yeah. I think someone in RP Gamer Chat, I think, said you can, like, I think you can even turn off, like, some of the hand-holding elements, they said. I'm going to have to look at that. So I wonder if you can maybe even, if you're really crazy, I don't recommend doing this, maybe you can turn off some of the icons on the map that show you important places to go. And kind of have that.
Wouldn't surprise me. It looked like there were a lot of options in the options menu.
Let's go take a look at that right now. Let's see what we got. And like I said, not something I'd recommend, but if you really want to do it.
Especially for first time players.
Yeah. Looks like you can change difficulty on the fly. Yeah, display toggle game objectives display, so you can turn that off. You can turn the minimap off for some reason. Quest rotate minimap. Automatic targeting of newly received quests. Display quest icon. Display new quest info. Display notifications. Display materials obtained. Display controls guide. Cursor memory. Enemy status. But you turn off the enemy status bar?
Yep.
Turn off display of enemy weaknesses, resistances. You can turn off the light bulb icon.
Yeah, if you just want the game to be as opaque as possible, that is still an option.
Yeah.
And I'll respect that. But I'll also respect it if you leave it as is.
Yeah.
Also, it's not worth pointing out, this is not a half-assed Switch port. This seems to run beautifully on it so far.
Yeah, that's fine. I've occasionally seen some longer loading times to get into an area, but I mean, once you're in the area, there's no loading times.
Yeah, loading in and out of battle is very quick, very brisk.
Let's see what Fireminer say in chat. The Yakuza Kiwami Switch port is confirmed to have licensed music. I don't know what that means.
There are songs that show up in various Yakuza games that are technically licensed that have routinely been removed from English versions.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
What's a theme song for the original?
Damn beast. Oh, what else did Fireminer say in chat? We'll talk about ukulele in a second. Any other thoughts on Romancing Saga?
It's really good. I've only had like 20 minutes to play it, so I can't speak as much for it as you can.
Let me try to talk
about it plenty.
Since I'm reviewing this, let's talk about some negatives.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these negatives are going to have caveats, because I don't think they're that big a deal.
Doesn't go too far enough.
Yeah. So the way the game is structured is something that I think makes perfect sense in the Super Nintendo area, but can seem a little off-putting in a more modern game. Like, hey, this is 90 years later, and I'm going to continue a quest with the same NPC there.
Don't worry about it.
He's acting like I just saved them, even though that was the last emperor who just went to live with a mermaid and disappeared forever. So that's weird. I don't think it's that big a deal, because this is not... This is a very gamey game. Like, I feel like if you only like story-heavy RPGs, this is already not a game for you.
It has a cool story, there's cool lore here, but that's not per se the point.
Yeah. The point is exploring a world and messing around with systems. It's kind of like I'm trying to compare it to more like a Final Fantasy V than a Final Fantasy VI.
Mm-hmm. It's a very mechanics game, but again, it does have like a really cool, like, the quest structures tend to be really interesting and more ambitious than a lot of Super Nintendo RPGs.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot to find.
Yeah, like the quest I just did, like the mermaid quest, has like a million steps, takes you all over the place, and I can't imagine how anyone actually finished it in the Super Nintendo.
One of the most famous quests in the game that I remember really stuck out to me when I played the remastered version, half a decade ago or so. was a quest that, like, you go visit another kingdom and then there's like an attempted coup. And if your
Oh, I
party
did that
wipes during
one.
that,
I did that one.
yeah, if your party wipes during that, you get like the quest fails and you have to go through and like if you will need to go back through and ultimately resolve it, but the way you have to do that changes quite heavily because your character died, and so there was like X number of years where that essentially that coup succeeded.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and like that's a like especially on Super Nintendo, that was like an extremely unusual way for anything to work,
Yeah.
and that's like still. In a modern game, that's still super weird. That's
Yeah.
still super unusual. And I think that's part of why this game it does stand the test of time in a way that a lot of games might not. It's just that, like, games like Saga, Romancing Saga was weird when it was new, and it's still weird now. And that's worth a lot.
Yeah, and it's weird in all the coolest ways, and I really would love more games like this. Like imagine, just like nothing to compare it to, but like imagine instead of having to pick like a few. Like a class-based, like Final Fantasy V or something like that, where hey, you're just using these classes or learning skills from classes and mixing and matching, and that's it. Kind of having access to swapping in characters from all the classes whenever you want, and just kind of messing around with everything and seeing what you can do in the battle system. There's just so many things you can do.
Yeah,
I don't.
it's got a wealth of options.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was gonna say, and that's not even mentioning that there are a bunch of new classes in this version. There's more than the original game had.
It was a system ripe for expansion.
Yeah.
But the way I would put it is that I've been thinking about this a lot, like usually in the context of early 3D games, but in general, like back when these games were new, a lot of major games would be like almost what we would think of as like art brut or outsider art by default, because there just wasn't an agreed upon way that games had to work. And I think one of the things that has really hurt design as a whole is this like idea that there's just a certain way that each thing needs to be done. And when you get one of the values of bringing back a game like this for a modern audience is that you get a reminder that like once upon a time, people didn't have so much prior art to draw from. There wasn't as much of an agreed upon idea of what X kind of game looked like. And you could get these really strange games that were unique then and sadly are still unique now because there just isn't anything else like it. And I think that there's a lot of worth in looking back at that and just re-examining underlying assumptions about how games need, like of any genre, need to be structured, like how they have to work.
Mean,
Because.
there's still not a lot of games like the original Saga. Like
Yeah.
there's plenty of games where, hey, you make your own party and you go on an adventure. There's very few where, hey, you make a party of characters, and hey, they all level up differently.
Yeah, one of the things that Saga has always done, that's been really that's made it hard for a lot of people to love it, but which has made, you know, people like us who do like weird things, love it so much is that it does question these really deeply underlying assumptions about how RPGs are supposed to work. Because, like, when you dig back into, when you peel back the mechanical underpinnings of an RPG so hard that you reach the very notion of how character advancement functions, and the idea that not all character advancement functions the same way, like, that is a huge challenge to what the player assumes and how they would normally expect it to work. And that's worthwhile, though, because it allows you to make something that is essentially an unforgettable experience, just because it's like nothing else is, you're never going to run into something that's like, oh, this just sort of did what Saga did, but better, because like nothing does what Saga does. Like, there's a couple of games that we can list off that are like, oh, that's a Saga style game, but yeah, you can name them on one hand.
Yes. Legend of Legacy, and still have fingers Alliance spare. Alive.
Yeah. And maybe, still have plenty of fingers to spare.
Maybe that Saga looking Game Boy indie game that I still need to play.
Yeah.
I don't know if and, that one actually plays like a Saga game, we'll have to see.
Yeah, and I mean, you'd have people who would argue with you about Alliance Alive.
Yeah, I would actually probably agree with a lot of them about that, because I feel like that's almost more a straightforward JRPG, and a lot of how it's Saga-y, I would say, is the weird way it kind of tells the story. It's not like a lot of games.
Which, yeah, and none of that's a knock, none of that's a detriment, but, you know, part of the reason that, you know, this series has a devoted following, despite I remember it being just the whipping boy for years and years and years in English, just because, like, it was such a weird franchise that no one really knew what to do with here. But part of the reason that it has such a devoted following is that you can't get what it's doing from anyone else.
No.
And so it's nice to see it get to come back like this. Like, we get two great Saga games in a year, and they're very different from each other. Even though they have design cues from each other, they are not they are not the same.
No. Very much and, so. Like, I feel like Emerald Beyond is very much more, not necessarily story-based, but kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. That game is just...
It's tabletop-y.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. It's way more tabletop-y, like, hey, here's a DM presenting you a story with choices and some cool battles.
Yeah. And this, honestly, is also tabletop-y, but in a different way.
Yes.
Like, the Scarlet Grace and Emerald Beyond are tabletop-y in the sense that your DM has a path that they want you to get to, and they haven't... and you'll get there roughly in the order they expect you to. It's just going to be a question of what you did while you got there. And Romantic Saga 2 is like, you're going to hit these plot beats eventually, but the things outside the plot or what order you did them in is all going to be quite variable based on just whatever you happened to run into. But Saga has always had a lot more of the underlying design philosophy of tabletop RPGs than any of its contemporaries. And sometimes that led it to places that made it deeply unpalatable to even the most deranged sickos.
Unlimited Saga.
What's that?
Unlimited Saga.
Yeah. But you know, it was always interesting. Like, we still talk about Unlimited Saga.
Yeah.
Like, it still comes up, whether to denigrate it or to like reevaluate it still comes up pretty often. Whereas, you know, like there's plenty of RPGs of its vintage that were fine, probably better liked at the time, but people aren't talking about them that much because they were fine. It was okay. And that's not to say they weren't worthwhile experiences, but like, you know, no one's thinking about Ligaia 2 Dual Saga right now. You know, just one of those things that's being weird, worth it. Let's see. Miyazaki once said in an interview that he can just be himself and doesn't care about the viewer's perspective when he directs movies. Saga's Kwasi's brainchild. Its idiosyncrasies come from him. That begs the question: can you be weird and yourself and still be universally loved? I think that there's certain kinds of weird that are easier to love. But the other thing is that once something becomes universally loved, it kind of ceases to be weird. And you know, maybe, you know, that was you. That was something deeply personal and that was weird when you made it, and then it becomes universally beloved, and now it's no longer weird. And it can still be deeply from the heart, but you know, once it becomes universally beloved, it is definitionally the norm. I do think that there is something to be said for the notion that art that speaks to everyone, it's not impossible for it to be it's not impossible for art that is broadly loved to touch people deeply, but I do think it becomes harder. I think that something that speaks to people on like a really personal level often kind of has to reject certain parts of the audience. It has to be speaking to someone more specific than just as many people as possible. And that doesn't mean that it has to reject a lot of the audience, but it does need to be built in such a way that it accepts that there are certain people who won't get it. I've said it myself. I consider myself to be one of the people who doesn't get it for Yoko Taro, who is a idiosyncratic author that many people that speaks deeply to many people, but who I simply do not get. And I think that that's the only way that art can work, you know, to some greater or lesser extent, is that it needs to be personal enough that there are people who simply do not feel it. Because that means that you know, you can be ineffective. You can just produce art that speaks to almost no one. But you know, if we're talking about effective art that communicates something real, your art kind of has to, if you want it to touch someone deeply, I feel like there's a degree to which there has to be people that will just bounce off it. Sorry, that was largely unrelated to any question or
No,
answer.
that's fine.
But yeah. And Fireminer lashes onto that previous question. So basically Freddie Mercury, and it's like, yeah, there's an argument to be made for that. Like, Queen had all sorts of like contravening opinions about it when Freddie Mercury was alive. About, you know, whether it was good or bad, or whether their music was good or bad, or what it stood for. That was a big question, but as time has gone by and they've been revered classics, it's clear that they have become the mainstream. Like, that is the influence on music and rock and roll as a whole is undeniable. And that is what it is to become the norm, even though, again, very strange music at the time that innovated in a lot of musical fashions. But
Love Queen.
Oh yeah. It was my mom's favorite band. But yeah. Let's see. But yeah, so big fan of what I've seen of Revenge of the Seven, which seems like it is it is related and recognizable compared to its forebear, but it's also made enough substantial changes and additions to be interesting and is a good interpretation of the strong sprite art of the original. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's even if you aren't interested in playing Romancing Saga 2, which you should please give it a shot, at least a demo or something. That's available on PlayStation, Switch, but please go back and listen to some of the original music and look at some of the original sprite art, because it's honestly some of the best that Square did on the Super Nintendo, and it just doesn't get a lot of play in the US simply because we didn't get the games. But they're still amazing looking for their time, and the compositions by Kenji Ito are just magnificent. Let me just make sure that I got his name right. Yeah, Kenji Ito. He's just a fantastic composer. Did music for, Saga 2 and the original, like, Seiken Densetsu and all three Romancing Sagas. He's kind of the saga composer. You'll still see new music from him in Emerald Beyond. But yeah, Ito's great. Super, super underrated in the US simply because not a lot of the games he really worked on were super popular here. But definitely deserves to be thought of alongside many of the great composers that Square worked with over the years. Let's see. Let's see, there's a new Mario Party, and as usual, people are complaining about the new Mario Party while still playing it. I don't understand, like, why, like, it's like when people start complaining about Mario Party is like complaining about how, like, Monopoly is unbalanced or something. It's like, that's really not its point. Like, the point is to have an excuse to play and get rowdy with three other people. Like, if you're complaining that a family board game doesn't always have the best player win, congratulations, you've failed to understand that that a family board game is designed to make sure that your, like, 7-year-old child is not constantly sad that they keep getting their ass beat.
This is not chess. Like, this feels similar to, like, the complaints that, oh, Mario Kart, like, rubber bands people in front. Like, yes, so everyone has a fucking good time. What is wrong with that?
Like, these are games that are designed to be played by people from, like, 3 to 300.
Yes.
And they're designed to make sure that all of them win at least some of the time. The way you do that is by doing things that make sure that the quote-unquote best player doesn't always win. That's just part of the game. I was looking, a friend of mine was asking about like designing for suboptimal play. I'll get to this ukulele question soon, I promise. But a friend of mine was asking about designing for suboptimal play and if I had ever heard stories from developers about doing that. And I brought up that a lot of developers don't like talking about that because it causes the most angry part of the audience to get even angrier. God, I love how weird and fucked up this enemy
is. This enemy steals fucking LP. What the fuck?
I like how one thing I wanted to say about how Saga games often challenge the idea of like really specific underlying systems working, of how those should work. LP, life points, which, you know, it makes sense to understand those as like, if you lose all of these, your character dies. That's not even true for all of them. It's highly variable what that actually does. Because the underlying systems don't need to, like, Saga is always questioning, like, why is this system the way that it is? Does it make sense for the game that we're making? But, yeah, so to finish out this thought, I pointed out that a lot of it's hard to talk about like specifically designing for suboptimal play because there's a certain kind of player that is the most angry part of the player base is also the one that's most likely to be angry about the idea of specifically designing for players of limited skill or, you know, for things that are not for optimization. But I was reminded of Call of Duty has a highly controversial feature called skill-based matchmaking that basically is designed to ensure that you're in a skill, like your matchmaking bracket is with people that are X notches above or below you at most. It puts you in generally like groups. Skill-based matchmaking is like the bane of a certain kind of player's existence. There's always calls for them to turn it off. And they've A/B tested this. They've tried it without telling people. And ultimately what ends up happening basically every time is that especially low skill players like they quit because they get stomped a lot more. But the thing that I thought was interesting when they did this sort of white paper that explained what they'd done, their top level summaries were interesting because it was interesting to see the conclusions that the development team had drawn from this. And one of them was just that like they could turn up skill-based matchmaking harder, and that actually improved the experience more for low to mid skill players, but high skill players disliked it because it meant that they were only that like the best players were only ever playing against the best players, and so there was never a point where, you know, they could play it and just feel like they were dominating. And when you look at their conclusions, you kind of see that that's partly the point, is that they aren't trying to eliminate lopsided matches. They're trying to make sure that there's a certain proportion of lopsided matches and that certain kinds of players aren't always on the receiving end of an ass whooping. Because like their exact description is something like, let me see if I can pull this up. I was talking about it just a day or so ago. An interesting way of raising it. Okay, so their exact phrasing was, another example with a test of Titan's skill in Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. This had inverse results consistent with the results of the loosening test. Quit rate was down for 90% of players, and we saw other improvements in the experience of low-skill players. However, we saw negative impacts for high-skill players. As a result, the change was not rolled out as a standard approach. in Modern Warfare 3 as we continue to strive for a balance in our approach to matchmaking. The system strives for team balance where players are not consistently on the wrong side of blowout matches. Which is a very specific phrasing because it says we're not, it implies we're not trying to stop blowout matches from happening. We're trying to make sure that you're not always the one getting blown out. Because for a lot of players, blowouts are the fun part. Because it's the time when they feel the most skilled, regardless of whether that's reflective of actual skill. It's the time when they feel the most, like, the most skill. A lot of players are less in it for competition and more for feeling like they've won. And so you need to allow blowout matches to happen in order for people to have that feeling. And so you have, you try to balance to make sure that players are on the winning team a fair amount of the time, and that sometimes that winning team really, really, really stomps. Mario Party's that. Mario Party is like, and Mario Kart, like, you just want to make sure that, like, yeah, you can win handily sometimes, but it's relatively rare. But it's also like, you know, the winner is not always going to be the best one. It's going to fluctuate because that's the way for the most people to have fun playing. You need to strategically designed to make sure that the most competitive player is not always the winner. Let's see, I've been watching people play Black Ops 6's campaign. Seems like the devs played Control and just decided to make an entire stage just Control. I mean, it's more fun than the usual Call of Duty fare. I mean, I got bored of Control like 3 hours in, so I can't speak for it, but I mean, like, I also don't play Call of Duty, so I can't speak for that either. I don't know. Something about it just didn't speak to me. Is the existence of competitive Mario Kart, Smash Brothers, and Pokemon a mistake? I'm not sure it's a mistake. Certainly, they want those games to be, to some extent, playable that way. They just don't want that to be the default way to play them. And they've been fairly good at that. Like, you can play all of those games competitively. There's ways to customize them and to house rule them, or just to play them unusually. But once you give someone a product, you can't tell them how they're going to use it. And to some extent, like, I think the mistake is mostly in the sense that a lot of people who play those games competitively think of themselves as a much larger proportion of the audience than they are. Like, you know, Smash Ultimate didn't sell 25 million units to competitive players. I'm not convinced it sold 500,000 units to competitive players. You know, Pokemon is not selling 30 million units a game to competitive players. Again, I'm not, it might, on my the most generous, like, if you just asked me to spitball a number, I would say, like, the most generous estimate I would give is 1 million competitive players, and that's being, I think, quite generous. You know, Mario Kart consistently selling 50 million units, it's not happening because of competitive Mario Kart players. If there's, you know, if 1/100th of those are competitive players, I will be mildly surprised. it'd be like saying, like, is competitive Scrabble a mistake? I mean, not really. But it's also not the reason it exists, and it's not who it sells to. And Wheels just left in the middle of me ranting. You know, the Pokemon anime always wanted to impart on people that Ash didn't win was not a big deal, but then they made a big thing out of Ash actually winning a championship. I mean, that was in part because it took 20 years, and the other part was that it was partially an excuse to be like, okay, we can wind down Ash because his goal was to be a master, and then they never really defined what that was. But yeah, it's, you know, there's no escaping that people want to see a character that they've seen struggle to do something for decades actually do it. You know, and it's not a deep or like structured enough story to de-escalate the idea of needing to win, because like it emphasizes that winning isn't everything, that there were plenty of other things that were worthwhile along the way. But you know, people want, people like the ultimate thing we see over and over is people do like winning. Like that's inescapable. There are wrestlers who are perpetual jobbers, yet they are still universally loved, but there are very few of them, and a lot of people like forever an underdog, no matter how lovable he is. Yeah, and the other thing is that, like, perpetual jobbers are, like, they're, like, beloved character actors. You know, like...
That's a good way to put it.
You know, because they're... fans of the art tend to really love a good professional jobber, because you can sort of see what they bring to a match, because you already have a strong appreciation for what actually goes into a wrestling match.
Really good jobber is someone that doesn't just lose all the time, but loses and makes someone look really good.
Yeah, a good jobber is someone who like makes their opponent look incredible for having for just what they did. Like, maybe that means that they put up a fight that makes it look like the you know, when you're a jobber to the stars, maybe you're, you know, putting up a fight that makes it look like they really overcame the odds to beat the shit out of you. If you're, you know, a base level jobber, it's like you're selling so hard that it makes every one of their moves look like it could kill a man. There's a lot of ways to be a great jobber. But yeah, you know, inevitably that kind of like professional underdog ends up drawing people who are very hardcore into something. He had a ukulele question that I don't want to see fall off again.
Oh yeah.
Now that a new ukulele is on the way, I just have got to ask, has that franchise successfully carved out a niche for it, or is this another first try? I'd say that there's, like, a niche for it. I think that this is partly them feeling like they don't have the pressures of, like, a Kickstarter. They don't have the pressures of needing to assert that this kind of game still has a right to exist. Because, like, you have to remember, when ukulele came out... when it was first in Kickstarter in like 2014, like the 3D platformer was not in a good place. There were a lot of indie 2D platformers. There were not a lot of indie 3D platformers, and big budget 3D platformers were basically Mario and Sonic, and sometimes the Sonic ones were really bad. Like seemingly completely at random, but ukulele needed to both assert that this kind of genre, this kind of game, still had an audience, and like Playtonic needed to build itself back up into existing again, basically. And so it was a game that had to serve a lot of masters. And so I'm sure that there were compromises that had to be made on that, because of its relatively low budget, having to build a team, just building the technology the game would be built on. There were just all sorts of reasons that it, you know, it released to mixed reception. I think it's a pretty good game. I think that, in general, the quality of indie 3D platformers has only gone up over the years. They've become really, really good. Shout-outs, once again, to some of the most fun I've had this year has been playing Pseudo Regalia and Corn Kids 3D. Or is it Corn Kids 64? I forget. But those are both great indie 3D platformers that play nothing like each other. One of them is basically a Metroidvania, and one of them is sort of a Banjo-Kazooie type construction. But no, we're not talking about Balan,
Joe,
you motherfucker.
No, stop. What the fuck?
But, you know, like, in general, the, like, and there are tons of, well, not tons, but there are plenty of, like, I was playing, like, Vroom Vroom Yellow Taxi. That's a really good indie 3D platformer. Like, there's a thriving subgenre of good indie 3D platformers now, and that just wasn't the case at the time. Like, that and Hat in Time were kickstarted around the same time, and it wasn't clear how much audience either would have beyond their Kickstarters. But over the years, like, you know, the genre has been reestablished. Playtonic has shown itself to be a really good, like, incubator to help a lot of these other indie 3D platformers have a place in the world. That's been really nice. I will never stop thinking about the time when we were at the height of NFT hell, where Team 17, one of their partners, the Worms publisher, who, like, they were partnered with on something, was like making a bunch of noise about how they were going to do a bunch of NFTs. And it was very funny to me that the Playtonic Twitter was like basically on Twitter they were like, "Hey, if you don't cut this shit out, we're cutting ties with you." but yeah, like, Playtonic has done a lot to, like, help incubate and publish certain, like, other 3D platformers, like Demon Turf. Like, they've been a great studio. Like, even if you didn't like Yooka-Laylee, they've been a great studio in terms of just what they've helped what they've been as a publisher. But, you know, now that that niche has been thoroughly carved, I think that it's fair to go back and be like, well, now that we're in a better place, what can we make out of Yooka-Laylee? And so I'm excited for Yooka Replay-Lee, which has been announced for everything. And by everything, I mean, it's been announced for, like, PlayStation, Xbox, and Nintendo. Like, not Switch, Nintendo. Because we're starting to see developers be a little less coy about, like, okay, yes, we are doing something for the Switch successor. But yeah, I really have a lot of respect for what Playtonic, the niche that Playtonic has carved itself in the industry. And did you play / like Penny's Big Breakaway? I need to get around to that. I do. Same. It's weird to see Shovel Knight Dig achieving much less buzz than the original Shovel Knight. It's just a case of the indie scene becoming more and more competitive. I think it's a little of that, but it's also Shovel Knight Dig's just a different kind of game.
Yeah, I don't think it's as big of a game in general as the original. It's not even the same developer.
Yeah, like, that's the thing, is that Yacht Club has actually kind of done the same trajectory, where they made a game, and but then, like, a lot of their time has been spent managing, like, helping other indie devs, and Shovel Knight Dig was another of those. But, like, what is the exact, like, play style of Dig?
I don't even know.
Like, that's the thing, is that whatever kind of game it is, it's not as immediately, like, it's not as easy a sell as here's a throwback 2D platformer. Like, it's a weirder kind of game. It was never going, and it wasn't, like, it's not like it was Shovel Knight 2. It's a spinoff, and so just in general, if you ever look at what the kinds of numbers spinoffs do, the answer is they almost always do sell to a subset of the original audience.
Yeah, I haven't even played Shovel Knight Dig. And I kickstarted the original.
Yeah, it's got... There's apparently some roguelike in it. But... Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like... I think that its biggest thing is just that, like, it's not Shovel Knight 2. And so it was always going to be just sort of like a less it, like people were going to care about it less regardless of its quality. I wouldn't even like the indie scene has gotten more competitive, but I do think that like Yacht Club is still like a company that when the people that care about the indie scene when they do something, people pay attention. But I do think that the fact that it's not a Yacht Club developed Shovel Knight game definitely hindered the amount of enthusiasm that it had. Let's see. How many spin-offs that got bigger than the original? Fate Grand Order, the Nanoha anime. Please look it up. I already know what you're talking about, and I'm not like I can't imagine how many people actually cared about Triangle Heart. But yeah, like it happens on rare occasions. Honestly, usually when the original is kind of niche. Like, usually when I think of like, oh, the spin-off is more popular than the original, I'm thinking of like the original was a cult classic and the spin-off was something that was built to appeal to a broader set of people.
Persona.
Yeah, Persona would be that. Unreal Tournament to Unreal. Yeah, in part simply because I don't feel like once you take away like the being technically impressive bit, the original Unreal simply doesn't have that much going on. It's just sort of like it's a technical showcase that's like kind of a mediocre first-person shooter. But yeah, like to point at my hypothesis in general, like you look at Persona and ultimately you're taking Shin Megami Tensei and you're twisting the knobs downward on being plot driven and twisting them up on it being character focused and character driven. And that takes that, you're taking an element that's a little less common to be like the reason someone comes to a work of fiction, and you're replacing it with something that's more common to bring people to a work of fiction. So ultimately, you produce something that ends up more popular. Yeah, River City Ransom to Kunio-kun. How big is Kunio-kun in Japan anyway? I don't know how, like, big enough that someone that every time its current rights owner goes out of business, someone buys it up, but. I mean, realistically, I don't think most people would have even thought too hard about like River City Ransom as a spin-off in Japan. Like, it would just be because it implies like that there's a core enough idea of what Kunio is. Like, yes, the person Akatsuko Ha Kunio-kun is a pretty straightforward brawler with a fucked up control scheme, but Kunio's kind of everything. Is there still space for Titanfall now that Apex Legends has gotten so big? I think so. I think that like Titanfall and Apex Legends deliver pretty different kinds of experiences.
Honestly, I think there's more space for something like Titanfall. I think there's too many, like.
Like we certainly there isn't a need for another thing to try to be the new battle royale. That
Yes.
genre saturated stuff trying to be that, you're
Yes.
going to hurt yourself. I do think that like the futuristic shooter is kind of an underserved market at this point. Like, back when Titanfall came out, Halo was a healthier franchise. But like that would be, even though they don't play much alike, that would be the thing that people would look at and be like, those are similar, even though they're not similar. Like the audience looks at that and it's like, that's the futuristic shooter franchise. But I would say that Titanfall, I think there's definitely room for Titanfall in the market, because I think that there's room for things that are less realistic competitive shooters. I think that Titanfall in particular had like a really interesting mechanic to keep matches interesting even when you were getting blown out. Like
The whole
playing
escaping
Titanfall.
mechanic.
What's that?
The whole escape mechanic, like you have to
Yeah,
evacuate
the
when you're
entire
on
escape
the.
mechanic was really interesting because it made sure that like even when your team was losing, you still had kind of a win condition where like and even when you and when your opponent saw that you were trying to escape, suddenly their win condition changed. Like they had won, but they wanted to really win. They had another thing they had to try to do, and it was really interesting. I think that that was brilliant. I really loved. I am not a competitive shooter person. I enjoyed playing Titanfall in just multiplayer because like the actual ebb and flow of a match was really interesting, even if I sucked at it. Like the way that when a Titan drops, suddenly, like it completely changes how everyone around you has to like you get that brief bit of asymmetrical power. Like even if you suck at the game, if you're on a Titan, everyone has to be careful about fighting you. And has to carefully consider what they're going to do. You'll probably get at least a couple of kills. Like the entire setup was really interesting and good for producing. Like even if you lost the match, you still had things that you could do that were personally interesting or satisfying. I think that there's still a lot of room for a properly marketed Titanfall. I would argue that Titanfall 1 and 2 were both very poorly marketed and kind of, and one of them at least was basically just sent to die. Like EA was putting out Battlefield 1, I think, the same month as Titanfall 2, and you'll never guess which one they promoted. But I think that Titanfall absolutely has a place in the market if it's promoted properly. Let's see. Would you want a new Wonder Boy game or a new Monster World game? Probably Monster World. Like, if we're considering them different, like the Wonder Boy games I actually like are like Monster World 2, Monster World 4. Like Monster Boy and the Cursed Kingdom, like those are the ones I like playing. Wonder Boy 1 is fine. It's a perfectly fine mid-80s platformer, but like I mean it's nothing that like I'd really like take notice of, but you know, especially after Monster Boy, which was a great revival of the Wonder Boy style, I'd absolutely play another one. Yeah.
Is there a point in remaking Mario Sunshine?
I think that there's a lot
Yes.
of fixes you could make to it. Like I loathe to say that, but like there's a lot of places where like I mean the point I would immediately make is just completely overhaul the game's internal, like the end game structure. Because, like, the structure of Mario Sunshine is so weird because it looks like Mario 64. It looks for all the world like it's just get as many, get X number of shines and you'll be able to finish. And the answer is no, that's not how it works. For those who never bothered, Mario Sunshine, you can't reach end game until you reach the seventh shine sprite on every world. And that feels deranged. Because it looks like Mario 64. You would think you just need to get a certain number, and it's like, no, you have to do the Shadow Mario mission in every level. And because of the rigid game way the game is structured, you can't actually do that until you've done all of the previous ones, except for a few places where you can break sequence. But just the entire structure is just weird. And like, say what you want, I don't think that I would suspect that was probably not how it looks in the original designs, And I would suspect that there was also not originally the intention for there to be 24 shine sprites that were only accessible via finding all 240 blue coins. My assumption is that both of those were compromises to get the game out faster because the GameCube wasn't selling very well. My suspicion is that a lot was sort of contoured late in development to try to get the game to a releasable state, however they had to get around it. And so I was not, so I would say that a remake of Mario Sunshine should probably, go in and just completely, overhaul the structure of the game to be something a little closer to Mario 64, where your number of shine sprites is, has a more obvious meaning. And, you know, make the game less rigidly structured and, you know, maybe just overhaul the blue coin system, maybe remove them, maybe change the, maybe add additional shine sprites, but, you know, it's something that makes them a little more, they're frustrating. They don't show up. You can go to the same place in the level in different missions and they just won't be there. Which just makes collecting all of them more obnoxious. And then, of course, there's just the fact that collecting them doesn't really do anything because they don't actually meaningfully advance the game state. There's just a lot of reasons that I would say, maybe go back and rethink how that... that's what I would do with a remake, is just reconsider the game structure. I will be, can I step out for a couple minutes?
Yeah, and then we should probably wrap it up when you come back, because I'm starting to...
Yeah. I will be back in 2 minutes.
Okay. Let me see if there's any other questions I can hit while he's away. Let's see. The minions to Despicable Me, Unreal Tournament to Unreal Persona to SMT... were those minions movies bigger than Despicable Me? I'm not so sure. This is a stupid thing to look up, but we're gonna look it up. They all have made a lot of money, so whatever. Is Phantasy Star Online 2 gotten bigger than Phantasy Star 4? What do you mean by bigger? More popular? Because there's probably more people who played Phantasy Star Online than played the original series. Let's see. Let's go take a quick look at the comment section. See nothing under 372 or 371, and 373 is not up yet. Comments there either. Is there anything in the Discord? No.
Okay. I'm back.
Okay, cool.
Check
in the comments section. There's nothing there.
Yeah, I checked it earlier.
Okay. Check in Discord real quick.
I wasn't expecting Fireminder to come out so hard against Phantasy Star 4, a game that I love. I wouldn't call it a perfect game, but I think it's a really neat one.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool game. I love Phantasy Star 4.
And definitely very, very interesting, like a rare kind of presentation for a cartridge game of that vintage. But yeah, let me we'll break off a couple question or two from the Discord just to make sure that we don't completely neglect that. Let's see. I'm having trouble navigating the Discord. Okay, there we go. If someone, okay, this one's for me and me alone. If someone told you with a serious face that Star Ocean needed more space exploration, what would you tell them? In other words, do people have a very specific definition when it comes to the aesthetic of space sci-fi? I would tell them that Star Ocean is one of those episodes of Star Trek where they're stuck on a non-spacefaring planet. And that's just kind of the aesthetic that the developers want for it. So, like, I don't know what to tell you. It's not really built into the series DNA. The one time they did one that was more, like, there's a lot of practical reasons as to why you wouldn't want to do that. Like, to make a bunch of planets that honestly feel alien from each other requires, like, so much more budget than the series has, that ultimately it's ultimately they're fantasy RPGs with like a twist of sci-fi in them, just that taste of sci-fi. Like, that's the approach that the developers have consistently taken with them, and I can respect that. That's fine. Hey, Burgundy. Let's see. Star Trek TNG / First Contact, a mistake for pushing the franchise towards a more space warfare direction. I'm not sure I'd say mistake. I think that it's important that, I think it's important that franchises have different I think it's important that franchises have different takes on them, especially something as broad-reaching as like Star Trek. There's so many interpretations of it. If you lock yourself out of something, like, I think that, you know, something like First Contact that is a more warfare-like conflict isn't even per se necessarily out of reach of the thematic core of Star Trek. It's just that it has to be portrayed a certain way to fit. And we can argue about whether, like, First Contact was the correct portrayal of that, but I don't think that the fundamental idea is wrong so much as the execution can be debated. But, you know, when you take these older franchises and you box them up too much, like, you box them up to a certain degree to make sure that there's, like, some kind of identity to them. But if you box them up too much, they rapidly just run out of things to do. And so, you know, you look at something like, because, like, I think that, you know, I have to admit, like, my favorite Star Trek is Deep Space Nine, and that definitely gets into the space warfare bit. But, you know, DS9 is doing that to approach the notion of, like, no matter how advanced society becomes, it is still humans. And, you know, aliens in this case, but aliens are, for want of a better term, very human. You know, and so But you know, if we looked at things from a purely like Star, there should be no war in Star Trek. Those a lot of those great stories from Deep Space Nine don't happen.
Fuck.
I'm glad to see that things are going great for you.
I used to final strike by accident and broke my weapon.
Oops.
Yeah, I'm gonna reload from whatever the last.
I want a Star Trek in which Q is the protagonist. I think that's basically a series. I think that's basically just the Twilight Zone with a weirder framing device. I do recommend that you go look up a playthrough of Star Trek Borg for the PC, because that is a lot of Q just sort of mugging at you. And then your reward at the end of the game is that you get to kick him in the balls. it's an experience. What's that?
Sounds worth it.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. Like, I mean, John DeLancey, whatever you want to say about him, he's very fun in that role. And it's entertaining just for that. I wouldn't recommend trying to find a way to make it work on a modern PC, and like for actual gameplay purposes, it's just an FMV game. But like in terms of, here's a lot of footage of John DeLancey mugging and mocking you for getting absolutely obliterated by Borg over and over and over. Like it's a very entertaining way to spend 30 minutes.
If you want to see him kill it in a different way, watch him.
Sure.
Watch him in Breaking Bad, because he's.
Oh yeah, he is in that.
He is, not for that long, but he is incredibly.
He's
good
where he's. Yeah, because he's the God. He's the lady that Jesse's. Trying to date during, like, her father, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, as with many things in Breaking Bad, that's a real heartbreaking.
Yes, and the way it ends,
that's a heartbreaking
and the
role.
Way he fucking plays the end to that whole storyline is... It's incredible. That show is as good as people say, by the way. Because I watched it all recently, and it was the trip.
It held up.
Yep.
But it held up to the scrutiny. But yeah.
He is amazing for his short role in that.
Let's see. Yeah. Okay. It's a shame that the number of people who know how to code id Tech 3 and 4 are fewer than UE or Unity. It's not surprising, and, like, you know, you do end up with, like, people get used to modern engine features and want to keep them, but you'd think that underpowered platforms would be the perfect place for older open source engines. Yeah, it's just hard to, like, if you want it to do certain kinds of modern things, you usually just want an engine that already supports them. There aren't that many games using id Tech 1 and 2 on the Switch, and Boomer Shooter developers who use them mostly focus on the PC. It's hard to justify with, like, id Tech 1 and 2, it's hard to justify just because, like, if you're doing those, you're usually making something that's very deliberately a throwback. And the audience for throwbacks is typically people who played the originals, and the audience who played the originals are typically people who played on PC, and those people never stopped playing on PC. So through that chain, it's just like, yeah, most of them are PC first, consoles maybe eventually. And I think there's interesting things to be done with old technology, but I also think that, like, you know, a lot of it is also just modern documentation. If you're working with Unity Unreal, not only is the original developer still supporting it, like, you're also in a situation where, like, you can, if you're having issues, you have a vast community of people to talk to. Whereas, like, if you're working with an old open source engine, yes, you'll find a core community that are there to help, and you'll find a lot of old documentation that may or may not still be valid. Especially if you're making customizations to the engine, like if you're making customizations to Unreal or Unity, like, you know, that's at your own risk, but you will have people from Epic or Unity who will work with you on, like, well, what was this trying to do? Why are you having problems with it? That sort of thing. Like, there is a support team that exists to help you. That was part of the licensing concept. If you're working with an old open source engine, you might get help, or you might get essentially the engine equivalent of works on my machine. And that's rough. That's a rough place to be. And so, you know, that does have its own, that does have its own perks, but, you know, a commercial team is going to be using, you know, is probably going to have access to newer technology that has the engine features they want already, blah, 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 blah. And for a bedroom coder team, like if you're just getting started out, like you're doing your indie shooter, yeah, you could try to learn these older open source engines. There's a lot of documentation of people fucking around with them. But if you just want to hit the ground running, there's going to be a lot more tutorials for, like, here's how to do X in Unreal or Unity. And, like, as with anything in like programming, like there's not a lot of just like that's impossible, but there's a lot of that's making things harder for yourself than it needs to be. I feel like, you know, you'd look at it, because you look at something like when Bloodstained was kickstarted, and there was like stretches to put it on the Wii U and the Vita, and neither of those versions ended up coming out. But the thought behind it was it wasn't impossible, even though it was on UE4, and UE4 wasn't on either of those platforms. It wasn't impossible. It probably wouldn't have worked very well, but it could have happened. You could have released that game and it would have worked, kind of. But like, there might not be a lot of impossibles, but there are a lot of this is going to be so much pain. This will not be worth it. Like, it would be easier to just fake the thing that you're trying, like, to you know, if you're going for, like, the old school look of the old id Tech games, a lot of times it's going to be easier to just fake it in the modern engine. Just because you'll have a lot more access to documentation and up-to-date, like, people to talk to, up-to-date, like, resources about making that happen. That'd kind of be my thought. Like, I think that there is appeal to that older technology, but I think that it just creates a lot more problems than it might look like it would on the surface. Okay, we wanna start wrapping this up.
Yeah, we should wrap it up. I'm fading.
Dog tired.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay. Well, our dear friend Michael Baker, Gaijin Monogatari, is not here this week, but we would be remiss not to plug his book series. So if you are interested in books about you know, young girls playing tabletop games and making just awful, awful, making sometimes awful social choices, but mostly awful dice rolling decisions. You can check out Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. You can find that on Amazon via print on demand or Kindle Unlimited. Joe didn't join us this week, but he does. He's still doing Spooky Hollow streams, despite I think not actually streaming most of these. But he's still doing Spooky Hollow streams this month on his YouTube channel, Smokin' Joe Gamer. You can ask us questions if you manage to catch us when we stream. That's at twitch.tv/askwheels at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Thursdays. We also have our sister show Shenanigans, where we mostly just sort of yell at each other and be kind of assholes to each other, while occasionally playing competitive multiplayer games. Shenanigans, that's on Sunday night. That's at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. If you don't want to ask us questions while we're streaming, you can ask us questions via the comment section under this episode on RP Gamer, or you can join the RP Gamer Discord by going to the community section of RP Gamer and clicking on the Discord invite link there. If you like your old RPGs or your new RPGs or just RPGs in general, it's a lovely community for discussing that. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See ya.
Ugh.